Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kehan. Today we'll discuss the article by Tanner et al. Titled, Dynamin-Related Protein 1 Mediates Low-Glucose-Induced Endothelial Dysfunction in Human Arterioles. This article published online December 6, 2016. Joining me today are consulting editor Michael Wolin, lead author Michael Widlansky, and content expert Prasad Kadakam. Let's get started.
Well, today we have a very interesting paper showing in human cells and tissues how mitochondrial function again continues to play a very important role in aspects of endothelial dysfunction, especially the study today on the conditions of low glucose, which is not something too commonly studied. Michael, maybe you could tell us about what's new in your study.
Thank you very much, Mike. We got interested in this area actually many years ago when published data came out looking at intensive glycemic control therapy in patients with diabetes that were expected to actually have robust positive results that did not seem to do so. And what was interesting about a lot of that data was it also seemed to show that adverse cardiovascular events seemed to track as well with the incidence and severity of hypoglycemic exposure. And so several years back, we published a paper actually, which showed that low glucose exposure in human resistance vessels does lead to acute impairment of vascular endothelial function. The question, of course, was what was potentially governing that? And prior literature had also shown that mitochondrial dynamics and dynamics proteins that were critically important to mitochondrial function. And so we were interested to see whether or not the mitochondrial fission proteins might, in fact, be important in this and why dynamin-related protein 1 or DRP1 became of interest. And so what really was new in this study is that we actually looked to see both pharmacologically as well as molecularly whether or not DRP1 could play a role in actually regulating vascular endothelial function, and whether that was through mitochondrial reactive oxygen species production as well, and ultimately reduction in NO bioavailability. And so but this study actually was designed to do is to demonstrate that, in fact, there does appear to be a role for DRP1 in this process.
I know, Prasad, you're a big fan of mitochondria and arterioles, and I'm interested in seeing what comes to mind when you've seen the results of this study.
I think this is the first report of implication of mitochondrial fragmentation in any pathology related to vascular dysfunction. And it's really fascinating. The evidence is very convincing. What I wonder is the effects are acute, and hypoglycemia and low glucose effects are known to have some kind of memory. And I don't know what Michael thinks about how long this effect lasts, particularly the effects on the mitochondrial fragmentation. And my second question is related to the other arm, which actually maintains the dynamic process of mitochondrial morphology, the fusion side of this arm, and what Mike thinks about mitochondrial fusion and how is it affected by low glucose.
Thanks, Prasad. Those are both excellent questions and ones we've been looking at. So what's interesting about low glucose exposure is how rapid we can actually induce vascular dysfunction. And if you look in the literature, hypoglycemia in humans or hypoglycemic exposures actually tracks better with the development of chronic dysfunction over time in diabetic patients than does their overall glycemic control or glycemic excursion. So there's some correlative data along that line in humans that kind of supports the concept. We know from also from prior work that people have done in humans that if you make a human, using hypoglycemic clamping and induce a state of hypoglycemia to say 50 to 60 milligrams per deciliter and hold them there for an hour to two, you get profound dysfunction. And it takes usually up to 24 hours plus for that to actually return to normal function, even in a normal healthy individual. So there is this sort of length, even after the acute exposure is gone, there is this period of time where the vasculature needs to recover from that insult. And the way I sort of think of putting that literature together, what we have here is that it's sort of like with exercise. To get the benefits of exercise, one doesn't need to be physically active 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's the repeated bouts of exercise that occur over time that lead to chronic changes. And I think what you see is a similar effect in the setting of low glucose or high glucose or glucose excursions is the same sort of thing happening to the vasculature. And I think that's borne out from prior literature, as I sort of alluded to, as well as when we look at our own vessels here from patients who have type 2 diabetes, they have the same dysfunction, the same impaired endothelium-dependent vasodilatation and impairment of NO bioavailability, even under normal glucose conditions. If you do molecularly manipulate DRP1 or if you use MIDV1 to inhibit DRP1, then you see the same reversal. So there is an acute component to this. And then I think there's a chronic regulatory component to it. And some of that chronic regulatory component to it may be the mitochondrial dysfunction that is occurring intermittently due to the dysglycemia. As respect to the second question, as far as fusion proteins, we haven't really looked specifically at them ourselves. We've been focused a little bit on the fission side of things. So I can't directly answer that, but I know that it's part of a pendulum. The mitochondrial dynamics process is, you know, basically a balance between the fusion and fission processes. And in fact, that too much fusion itself may also be a problem as well. So there probably is a careful balance to be made between the activity of the fission and fusion proteins. But we haven't looked specifically in our own models yet to sort of answer that question, but it's a very good one.
One last question relates to your observation that these mitochondrial fragmentation happens, and these fragmented mitochondria seems to display hyperpolarization. But when you look at typically when mitochondrial fission occurs, usually fission occurs when there is loss of membrane potential in the mitochondria, and the fission process is triggered, and that leads to mitophagy. Any thoughts about how this hyperfragmentation is associated with the hyperpolarization of mitochondria?
Another good question. I don't know that we know exactly, when mitochondria undergo fission, why you get more ROS production, why you get more superoxide production. I think one could theorize that the proteins of the electron transport chain may be coming in more disadvantageous configuration, leading to less fidelity of the passage of electrons down the electron transport chain. But I don't think that's ever really been something that has been proven. Why there is hyperpolarization, well, is a good question. What we've seen, at least when we stress cells in this manner, is it's sort of the early part of the process. So if you maintain this for a longer period of time, what you'll see is eventually depolarization and then autophagy and trigger the apoptotic process. So in looking at this, what we're probably seeing is what the early stages of the process are. And then when we persist with a toxic exposure for a longer period of time, that's when you get the rapid depolarization that occurs and then autophagy.
Is it possible that what you're seeing, because you're using the MitoTracker to look at the morphology, this is, I understand, is membrane potential based mitochondrial dye. Is that right?
We use the MitoRFP in this study. So there is some dependence of it, but not as much as some of the other MitoTrackers, based on my understanding of it. We use other dyes with this too. We use MitoTracker Red, which is more sensitive to that. We've used TMRM in other cases as well, that we didn't use that data in this particular study, which you get to see more of the process. But we didn't see a lot of intensity differences in the normal versus low glucose exposed cells in this particular study. So I don't know that it necessarily was an impact on the results.
In my point of view, the fascinating part of this study is how it actually is counterintuitive in many ways. One, you're not seeing any differences with low glucose in the mitochondrial oxygen consumption rates. And you're not seeing the hyperpolarization itself is a dogma. All these things really make it very interesting for future studies, and I think opens the door for some novel mechanistic studies for the future. And I really like the study.
Well, thank you very much, Prasad. I mean, I think there are a lot of open questions, as you've already alluded to. First of all, how is DRP1 even activated? I mean, yeah, we have a phosphorylation at the 616 activation site, but how does that actually occur? Where does that signaling come from? We don't know. what docking proteins are involved here. Is it FIS1 or MFF or other docking proteins involved potentially here? The energetics thing, I think, was important for us to test. An obvious point was, you know, is what we're seeing just simply related to adverse bioenergetics occurring under low glucose conditions? And we were actually kind of surprised, honestly, to see that it wasn't. There was really no effect, that this appears to be more of a molecular and signaling process than necessarily one related to the bioenergetics of ATP production. So I agree, there are multiple different avenues we potentially go with this. I think what we're currently sort of really interested in is how does this signaling process actually begin? How does, once you expose endothelial cells to low glucose, how does that then transduce into a signal to lead to mitochondrial fragmentation? And sort of our next wave of studies.
We've uncovered many new questions in this study. Low glucose is a condition. What happens to fission with mitochondria with low glucose, relationships with membrane potential, relationship between membrane potential and reactive oxygen species production, and these being parts of basic signaling mechanisms, which may be somewhat independent of energy metabolism. And Michael, I think you should be congratulated on a very good translational study, which may have many major future implications.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology podcast. For more podcasts like this, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.